From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. Later this month, China's President Xi Jinping will host dozens of foreign leaders to talk about China's massive Belt and Road Initiative. First floated by Xi 6 years ago, this project has brought tens of billions of dollars in Chinese financing for new roads, pipelines, ports, and other infrastructure to countries across Asia and Africa. Projects usually built by Chinese companies. More than 120 nations have signed on to the plan, and while in its early days the project was geared towards countries along the ancient Silk Road from China to the Middle East, the Belt and Road Initiative is now being extended deep into Europe and Latin America. Chinese workers have built bridges in Serbia, a huge railroad tunnel in Uzbekistan, and a gas and oil pipeline across Myanmar, just to name a few. Now, the project has become a centerpiece of China's foreign policy as it seeks to increase its political and economic reach around the world. But of course, the Belt and Road Initiative has been met with a lot of skepticism, particularly in the U.S. and Europe. 6 years after Xi announced what's become one of the largest foreign infrastructure projects in history, there's still much about it that isn't known or well understood. So on this edition of Global Journalist, a look at China's Belt and Road Initiative and whether China is accomplishing what it hoped to do. Now, we've got a great lineup of guests to talk about this. We'll kick things off with Joshua Eisenman. He's a professor at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas, who's been researching the initiative. Joshua, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here with you.
Well, it's nice to have you. Now, there is this big meeting on the Belt and Road Initiative set to take place in Beijing. Remind us just briefly, if you're a country that wants a highway or a big railroad bridge or a pipeline and you go to this meeting, what sort of deal is China offering?
Well, I think the most important thing to remember is that while we often hear of this in terms of investment, this is loan financing first and foremost. So these are loans, sometimes concessional, sometimes market rate. It depends on the negotiation. And what you have is a country going and taking a loan and then hiring, according to the rules, a Chinese firm, which then comes in and does the infrastructure work in that country. But the loan is still paid for by the government, which means that this is a country investing in themselves and China providing the financing to do it. There are a lot of differences about this and the way that other countries do loan financing. It's G to G. It's government to government. And the United States has for a long time not lent government to government. We tend to use banks, Bretton Woods institutions, the World Bank, IMF. So China's approach is unique, and it's a case of a contested multilateralism in the world today because China is both a member of these other institutions and setting up another initiative which to some degree challenges that.
So in other words, then, to some extent, this has displaced lending that the World Bank and some of these other institutions that you mentioned have historically done. But if we can just step back for a minute here, I mean, this initiative was announced 6 years ago. China had long been sort of financing these big infrastructure projects for a number of years in Africa and other countries before this Belt and Road Initiative was launched. So what's different about the Belt and Road Initiative?
Well, there are a variety of things, and it's a great question. The first is the transparency. We do not know, and these are not transparent deals. And so the only people who know are the people on the two sides. And in fact, there are specific gag clauses within the deals that prohibit the borrowing country from speaking about them without the Chinese approval on the other side. The other is the scale of this, the size of it. You mentioned before in your introduction, this is just bigger than anything that China has ever done before, that we've maybe even ever seen before. And size matters, especially when we're dealing with countries and initiatives like this. You talked about the many billions. And branding. In the past, China was doing deals, but it seemed to be almost ad hoc. But now we have a national brand association associated with it. We've got billions spent also in the conferences and the meetings and the feting that goes along with that as well. So the politics that goes along with the economics is equally, if not more important than the processes themselves. And so this is really a kind of critical element of influence building around the world. And when countries sign on to the initiative, they're signing on to simply more than an economic initiative. They're also signing on to a political initiative. And that's really important here for China and the ruling Communist Party.
Right. And I think I'd seen an estimate by Morgan Stanley saying that China was planning to invest something like $1.3 trillion into this initiative by 2027. But I wanted to ask you as well about sort of the economic benefits to China, because you have this whole stew of projects all across the world, and some of them clearly have an economic benefit to China. Like some of the projects have been like building roads through Central Asia that clearly are meant to be used to ship Chinese goods out and to bring raw materials in. Or I think there was a big pipeline built across Myanmar. But some of these other projects, like China's built a bridge in Montenegro, or it's planning to build or rehab a railroad in Mali in West Africa. It doesn't seem like there's sort of a direct benefit to the Chinese economy on these.
Well, I think the most important thing to remember is that domestically, the Belt and Road Initiative is intended to increase economic growth and deploy excess Chinese capacity around the world in terms of construction capacity. So whether or not that bridge is actually helpful, as long as it's deploying and using these excess capacity that China has in its construction firms, then it's doing a service. It's doing a service. It's keeping people employed. It's keeping that firm productive and making money. So it has a value. That being said, of course, there are some projects that are more important to China than others. Another important thing to keep in mind is that much of the Belt and Road is actually domestic at this point. There is both an international component and a domestic component to the Belt and Road Initiative. If you look at the maps of the initiative, you can see that they begin sometimes very deep inside of China and then project outwards into the world. So that means that there's investment going on both domestically and internationally, which is keeping this excess resources deployed around the world and therefore keeping GDP growth, which is an essential component to success as far as the Communist Party regime has calls it. So this is not only an international plan to woo and to fed and to grab more influence around the world. It's also about employing domestic capacity and meeting those domestic concerns. So I think that's an underappreciated element of this. We should also understand there's a role between what China is doing domestically in terms of its technology and its infrastructure and what it's bringing outward as well. And there's a connection here. So if you don't, or you do, like what's going on inside of China, if you're a Belt and Road country, you should prepare yourself for more of that in your own country.
Well, Joshua Eisenman, I had just one more quick question for you. Recently, you know, at the start of this project, it seemed like it was geared mostly towards the developing world, but it's recently, as we mentioned, expanded to Europe. And we saw just in the past couple of weeks that Italy has signed on to this initiative. What's the significance of that partnership?
Well, mostly political. It's great for the Chinese to be able to say, look, we're our Belt and Road Initiative is being accepted in the West. It's being it's not competing. It's becoming part of the new globalization 2.0. And look, here we have this Western country, Italy, who has signed on. My understanding of this, and things are the details are not, as I said before, clear. But my understanding is this is different than other Belt and Road because this is within the EU, and therefore you can't have these closed bid contracts like you can in countries that are non-EU countries. So this is a real test for Belt and Road about whether or not it can deploy its same methods within a Western context, a rule of law context. There's a there are EU laws which have to be abided by here, and so that changes the nature of the Belt and Road as it exists within Italy versus how it might exist in Sri Lanka or a country that doesn't have to abide by these extra set of guidelines.
Well, Joshua Eisenman, thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
This is Global Journalist. On today's program, we're talking about China's Belt and Road Initiative and how it's shaping the country's global relations. Up next, we're going to bring in Jacob Mardell. Until recently, he had been researching the Belt and Road Initiative at a think tank called the Mercator Institute in Germany. But he decided that doing research from an office wasn't enough, so he set out on a 37,000-mile voyage from London to Southeast Asia to visit firsthand as many of these Chinese-financed Belt and Road projects as possible. He joins us now from Belgrade, where he's been visiting construction sites in Serbia. Jacob, welcome.
Pleasure to be here. Hi.
Well, this is an unusual journey that you're on. Tell us just briefly about why you decided to do this and what your itinerary is.
My itinerary is quite long, so I'll try to keep it brief, but it's from the UK to Southeast Asia, through most of Europe, Turkey, and Central Asia. And then after I eventually arrive in China at some point in October, I'll be visiting Southeast Asian countries and then returning back to Europe by cargo ship. So the point of the journey really is to see these projects, how they're progressing on the ground, but also to talk to people, stakeholders and commentators about their perspective, to sort of get a local flavor for what China means in all these countries.
And I know we're getting you just at the beginning of this trip, but you have been to Belarus, to the Ukraine, and now in Serbia. Talk to us about some of the projects that you've seen there and what the impressions are of the local people that that live near them.
You're right. I'm just at the beginning of my journey. I've only been traveling for 6 weeks, but I have got a chance to see quite a large industrial park in Belarus, just outside of Minsk. And I'd say the perspective is, it depends on what perspective you're coming from. If you're expecting incredible fast growth, then you might be disappointed with the state of these developments. But I can vouch for the fact that there are things happening on the ground. There are construction sites. Only 10 of the 43 resident companies in this investment park are operating, which might sound disappointing if you consider that the park's been developing for 7 years, but these are still 10 companies that are providing jobs to people. There are still construction sites. So the reaction to the Belt and Road and to China generally in at least Belarus and Serbia, where I'm at, is very different to the perspective in Brussels or Washington, D.C., whereas Western Europe tends to view China with something between a mixture of lack of awareness and fear. Here, China is glorified, or at least seen as a real economic opportunity.
And what about in Serbia? What kinds of projects is China doing there?
Several roads and bridges. So the first sort of major infrastructure project, it was the Pupin Bridge, China-Serbia Friendship Bridge, opened in 2014, connecting Belgrade with northern metropolitan area. And there's been sort of a gradual development in the complexity of projects. So there's more roads and bridges. There's a power plant being developed, and there's also several investments. They bought a steel mill, basically saved it from ruin, and providing local jobs as part of a clause in the sort of in the acquisition to keep these jobs. And recently, they've just announced a greenfield investment tire factory. So it's developing in complexity in terms of the economic relationship.
Well, there, as you mentioned, there's been a lot of concern in Brussels, in Washington about this, as China has sort of moved these projects from the periphery of the EU, places like Belarus or Ukraine, you know, sort of directly into the heart of the European Union itself. Member states like Poland and now Italy mm-hmm. are part of this project. Now, I think a Chinese company has also purchased a big port in Greece called Piraeus. Mm-hmm. Are these right. fears about a growing Chinese influence as a threat to the EU, do you see these as justified?
I think some of them are justified and some of them aren't. I think the picture that we see in the media tends to be very much simplified and reduced. I think there are legitimate concerns with the Belt and Road and with the way Chinese companies operate. And I think there are concerns that are perhaps overblown. I particularly think in European and American media, this idea that China has sort of a strategy, sort of trying to infiltrate Europe, I think is incorrect. I don't think there's any grand strategy. I think it's just a case of Chinese companies wanting to do business. And this comes with its own set of problems. But particularly in the Balkans, for example, where I am, there's this sort of narrative that Serbia, for example, might be kind of Trojan horse to the EU. You know, the Chinese investments come here and then they sort of maybe if Serbia becomes part of the EU at some point, then sort of China gets inside the EU. But it's sort of this picture overlooks local agency, the sort of will of local politicians. they want cooperation with China for their own reasons. So it's not a case of China deliberately trying to infiltrate Europe. It's a case of China being there and a willing business partner.
Well, Jacob Mardell, thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you.
A reminder that you are tuned in to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. On today's program, we're talking about China's Belt and Road Initiative that is financing infrastructure projects all across the world ahead of a big meeting in Beijing later this month. If you're interested in more Global Journalist, check us out online at globaljournalist.org. There you can find our archives and additional coverage of underreported international news and human rights issues. You can also like us on Facebook, where we live stream, follow us on Twitter, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, or see our videocast on YouTube. For more perspective on the Belt and Road Initiative, we're going to bring in two other guests who have been tracking it closely. Joining us now from Toronto is Naishka Chandran. She's a Singapore-based journalist who covered Asia for CNBC for several years and is now a contributor to Vice News and other outlets. Naishka, welcome.
Hi, Jason. Thank you so much for having me.
And also with us from Washington is Taya Smith. She was a China expert in the Treasury Department during the Bush administration and is now director of the China program at the Climate Leadership Council. Taya, welcome.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, Taya, if I could start with you, we're several years into this massive project. And a lot of people view this whole initiative as sort of a response to the Obama administration's pivot to Asia. You know, how successful has this been in terms of increasing China's soft power, sort of its ability to influence other countries?
So the whole project, I think, is viewed really by most people around the world from the perspective that they come. So if you come at the project saying, we're looking for development, as many of the host countries for BRI are, it's been very successful because they've been able to get access to resources and funds that they haven't previously been able to get access to without all the strings that the US or many Western countries require their financing to bring.
So, Taya, it seems like these projects financed by the Chinese, they don't have the sort of environmental impact reviews, the same labor standards, some of these other considerations that the World Bank or other institutions take into account when lending.
Exactly. Many of the Chinese lenders have been much more lax in the requirements than funding has coming from Western companies or through the World Bank and other international institutions. So if you are a host country that is looking to get a coal-fired power plant built in your country quickly, then BRI is a great way to go. Unfortunately, other host countries have found that alongside of this, some of the environmental requirements from the World Bank or IFC are actually quite helpful for them. And so they found that the BRI projects that are being built into their countries are actually causing long-term environmental damage. And so from their perspective, BRI has not necessarily been successful. But I think you just need to take a look at the overall numbers in order to decide where you're at. Right now, BRI projects are affecting almost a quarter of the population of the world. So 4.4 billion people, a quarter of the world's GDP, I'm sorry. And that's an enormous impact. And the fact that China has been able to reach BRI projects so quickly around the world is a testament not just to the fact that there's a real need for a different view and perspective on development, but also the reach that China now has in terms of engaging with international markets and countries in quite a distance from itself.
Well, Taya, I want to come back to that point, but if I could turn this to you, Naishka Chandran. So we're 6 years in since President Xi announced this project. Generally speaking, as these leaders gather later this month in Beijing to talk about the future of it, has this been a win-win both for China and its partner nations, or are the reviews going to be more mixed?
That's right, Jason. Ahead of the second summit, which comes about 2 years after the first one, China does have a lot of wins in its book. For example, we've seen Italy and Switzerland become the latest European countries to join the BRI. Others, we've seen Hungary, Poland, Greece, and Portugal, which have already indicated their willingness to join. So having those European players participate is a huge benefit. But then on the other side, we've had just massive amounts of concerns, not just within Asia, but across the developing world about unsustainable financial burdens that the BRI is placing on host countries. The other big factor that many people are worried about is about the execution. You know, we've heard multiple reports about Chinese finance infrastructure projects not being able to run properly. They're being faced by public opposition. There are objections over labor policies, performance delays, multiple suspensions. So a lot of these projects aren't even properly working to their full capacity. So that's a major concern.
Sure, and certainly, Naishka, if you don't mind, talk to us about sort of maybe the best example of this. This is a massive port in Sri Lanka that was built a couple of years ago by a Chinese company. I think the overall cost was about $1.5 billion. What happened there?
Right, so Sri Lanka is emerged as sort of a classic example of what happens when Chinese investment can go wrong, in a sense. You know, we saw that when Sri Lanka was unable to pay its loans for Chinese infrastructure projects, the government in Colombo had to sell one of its strategic state assets, which was a port in the southern part of the country. And they sold it over to the Chinese, which are now running it. This is an example of unsustainable financial burdens when governments who are unable to meet their liabilities will have to sell off, you know, important assets. And other countries across Asia do not want to fall into the same example as Sri Lanka did. So we've seen countries from Malaysia to Pakistan to Myanmar to even Sierra Leone in Africa renegotiate their BRI investments to avoid taking on too much debt.
So there is this, it does seem like there is this real fear of being caught in sort of a debt trap and owing China more money than you can pay back. But Taya Smith, if I could turn this back to you, the Trump administration pulled the U.S. from the Trans-Pacific Trade Agreement, which was designed apparently to counter the influence of China really across Asia. How effective has the U.S. been in responding to the Belt and Road Initiative sort of since that? What's the U.S. strategy?
So the U.S. strategy is stumbling along. I think actually the Trump administration has done a good job of trying to really look at the key parts that BRI points to in our own world. So the U.S. for a long time has been very fractured in terms of we have different development assistance programs going along in different parts of the U.S. government without a lot of communication and certainly not a lot of strategic goal setting. So the Trump administration has tried to pull together many of those institutions with OPEC and EXIM working together now under this development finance rubric, but has not yet, I think, really brought together how that's going to work with USAID and other forms of development. One of the powerful pieces of BRI is that the whole of the Chinese government has been fairly supportive of the project and worked together effectively to bring the different components, the different resources together to build out some of these projects. And that's a much more powerful piece than the U.S. approach, which has always been very piecemeal.
Well, and Naishka, if I could return to one of the points raised earlier in the program, I wanted to ask you about some of the criticism for this initiative, and that is sort of its lack of transparency. Not only is it hard to sort of assess overall what China's sort of grand plan is, but the terms of each of these deals with certain countries, they aren't always clear. Talk to us about that.
Right. I mean, OPEC finances is probably the biggest issue surrounding the BRI. In fact, there's a great report by the Center of New American Security that was released earlier that month that gave a kind of checklist for, you know, countries willing to participate in the BRI, what they should avoid. You know, number one on that checklist was try to obtain clear financing arrangements. At present, the BRI is financed by complex financial tools, which include grants, loans, concessional loans, credits. These are being instrumented by Chinese policy banks, as well as a variety of state-owned enterprises, which include development finance institutions. But the bidding process for contracts and financial terms, they're not available to the public. So as a result, we don't really know, we're not able to offer clear assessments on how fair these deals are. You know, and that's led to concerns of what's being called debt trap diplomacy, where countries are afraid that Chinese funds will be used to gain political leverage over developing countries. And Jason, I just want to add on to one more point to what Taya was mentioning earlier about Trump's initiative to respond. You know, following Obama's Asia pivot, we've seen Trump come up with his Indo-Pacific blueprint, which many consider as the follow-up to the Asia pivot. And under this Indo-Pacific blueprint, we've seen the U.S. announce millions in infrastructure spending for the Asia-Pacific region, as well as they've created a new development finance agency with a lending cap of, I think, $60 billion, which many believe is a clear alternative to Chinese investment. So we do see a kind of competition building up between Washington and Beijing in terms of who can be the more reliable source of finance for Asian infrastructure.
And Taya Smith, if I could turn this back to you, where do you see the Belt and Road Initiative moving over the next 3 to 5 years? Are we going to continue to see this sort of explosion of Chinese lending and, you know, infrastructure projects, the construction of more new roads and railroads and gas pipelines really all across the world, or are we going to see a pullback?
I think it's going to continue for sure. I mean, there's so much winning that the Chinese have from this project, both in terms of extending soft power, but also very much hard power in terms of security and getting access to locations. One of the important things about the Sri Lankan port project is that China has never been able to get that close to India before. And now they have access to a port that gives them direct insight into India from a strategic or security perspective. That's very, very concerning, both for the U.S., but definitely for India and South Asia. So China's definitely going to continue moving along that track. What we're hopeful for is that there is now a very strong environmental standards approach that's been created within China. And hopefully is going to start to be implemented as things go forward. At the same time, though, many of our multilateral development banks and others are finally on the bandwagon and recognizing that their job is to work with these host countries and make sure that the host countries are able to negotiate the strongest deals for themselves and make sure that the host countries are able to understand the ramifications of, certainly from an environmental or social impact perspective, what they have to require in all of their lending and infrastructure deals that they do with China.
Well, we're out of time for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to Joshua Eisenman, Jacob Mardell, Taya Smith, and Naishka Chandran for joining us. Our assistant producers this week are Molly Jackson, Kyle Lahusik, and Francesca Stadelmeyer, with supervising producer Rosemary Belson. Megan Smaltz is visual editor, Aaron Hay is audio engineer. Travis McMillan is our director. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.